Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Party, man.
Right on.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Don't need to escalate. See, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Soul tunes ever. What's going on? Marvin Gaye, released as a single in January 1971. This was the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The life of Marvin Gaye is our topic in this portion of the program. Marvin Gaye biographer Steve Turner is our guest. With Steve Turner's help, we'll look at the life of this great pop singer, a singer who the NAACP named the nation's most socially significant entertainer. Gaye made a tremendous contribution to soul music and Motown sound. But Gaye was a deeply troubled man. He suffered drug dependency. He had financial problems, legal problems. His relationships with women were troubled. And so was his relationship with his father, the man who would fatally shoot him in April 1984. Steve Turner's biography of Gaye is titled Troubled Man, The Life and Death of Marvin Gaye. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Steve Turner. Join the discussion with the telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Steve Turner has written about music for many publications, including Rolling Stone, Mojo, and Q. He is also the author of books on the Beatles, Jack Kerouac, and Van Morrison. Trouble Man is published by the Echo Press. Steve Turner, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Marvin Gaye, do you see him as a tragic figure?
Yes. I mean, I think he had so much talent and so much to give, and yet he seemed to have made mistakes on the way. And I don't think he did make obviously good music, but I think if he disciplined his life in a better way, he could have made more of it. And it obviously was tragic that he was the kind of collision course that he was in with his father. life, really. I mean, I think as soon as he was born, there was a sense of jealousy there, and that grew as Marvin became, listening to gospel music and getting attention in the church, and then getting attention as a pop singer later on. That really sort of enraged the father, and it was just a sort of a collision course, an accident sort of waiting to happen, really.
Yeah. His mother, Alberta Gay, said Marvin Jr. didn't want Marvin. And that must have had, didn't think about that right there.
Sure. She seems a very loving, has been a very loving woman and a very genuine Christian woman. He seems, the father seems to have been a hypocritical person, really, because he was obviously saying one thing in the pulpit and behaving a completely different way at home, being very vicious and violent to his children, and having sort of unusual relationships with other women in the church, and really Susan's wife in a terrible way. And so Marvin grew very close to his mother, and it was his mother that really encouraged him when he wanted to get involved with music.
Mm. Marvin's childhood friend, Buddy Comedy, said the only thing Marvin wanted from his father was approval. Did he ever gain any sense of approval from his father?
Not that I could ever find out. No, I don't think his father ever told him that he loved him, or ever showed him that he thought that his achievements in the music business were great, because I think he liked the rewards of having a son who was famous and who was rich. I mean, he didn't seem to protest when Marvin bought him a car. He didn't seem to protest when Marvin bought him a house in Los Angeles. I think he liked the attention that came with it. When Marvin, they had a special day for him in Washington, D.C. shortly after What's Going On album came out, and the father was there and sort of basking in the attention. But through all that, he was never able to say, you really did well. Although in his heart, Marvin was getting the sort of attention he would have liked to have had. I mean, that was the sort of attention his father, who was a pastor in a church, that's the sort of attention he would have liked to have had as a pastor. He really wanted to be a big figure in the particular denomination. He never made it, and that really caused him to pull out of the church eventually. So although he's described as a pastor, even at the time he got Marvin, he hadn't been a pastor for many, many years, but he hadn't even been going to church for many, many years.
Mm. Religion was important in the Gay family. How did Marvin Sr. get religion?
Well, Marvin's grandfather, in other words, Marvin's father's father, he had a drink problem. He was not a religious person. But the mother was a religious person, and this particular denomination set up in Lexington around the time that his mother had just started having a family. And I think she was raised as a Methodist, but she got involved with this church, and I can only imagine that the obviously the Christian church should be interested for that reason, but it obviously supplied some kind of joy and community and excitement when their own family set up was rather difficult with the father having drink problems. And so Marvin Sr. grew up in that church, and as a young man began preaching, and then began sort of touring around nearby states. That was based in Lexington, Kentucky, going around nearby states as an evangelist. And that's how he finally ended up in Washington, and that's how he met Alberta, his wife.
And Marvin began singing in the church. How did the church influence him?
Well, their particular church was quite small. I mean, I think it began, well, it was really no more than a storefront church. I don't think it ever really got much bigger than that. But they did have these big annual conventions in Lexington, Kentucky, and that's when a lot of people that I talk to remember seeing Marvin perform as a child. He was a good-looking young boy, and I guess he'd be like 6 or 7 years old, and his father would be preaching, and he would go along and would sing some songs. And he'd also had piano lessons, so he was not just a singer, he was a musician. And the women quite took to Marvin and were very charmed by him. And that's when people can remember the kind of seeds of jealousy becoming quite apparent in the father. He didn't like the son getting the attention that he thought that he deserved. So he grew up with that whole inheritance of spiritual hymns and gospel music. And I don't think Evan really lost his love for that sort of music. But then that story was true for almost every soul musician of that generation. They nearly all grew up in the church, and quite a few of them, people like Aretha Franklin, I think Wilson Pickett, I can't be sure, but a lot of them, their fathers were actually ministers or pastors.
You know, listening to the album, What's Going On, recently in preparation for this interview, you know, it really comes through loud and clear that this whole album is very much like a sermon.
Yes, I think he, I mean, the genius of it seems to have been that he was able to fuse all the disparate interests that he'd had over the years, like his interest in gospel music and his interest in the church and religion, had really taken a backseat as far as the music that he was doing the record was concerned. But presumably, the interest was there. And he was also interested in being a Nat King Cole type of singer. And the music that he was doing for Motown during the 60s was very much sort of R&B soul. And so although he did record some smoother music, that really never been brought together and were brought together. And as you say, there's a lot of sermon, I think, on the song. I think on the album, I think part of it, in a sense, felt the calling to do something, and maybe that was sort of inherited through his father, and he'd obviously sat through a lot of sermons, and so sermonizing came quite easily to him. But almost, you know, every song on this album is about something, about some social problem. It really was a breakthrough for that type of music. And very gaudy because it wasn't the sort of album that Motown was putting out at the time. I mean, Motown was supposed to be the sound of young America. That was the slogan that very gaudy used for Motown. And the sound of young America meant the growth of optimistic dancing in the street sound, basically. You know, young people falling in love and having a good time. And this kind of picture that Marvin was posing with references to Vietnam and pollution and inner city problems was really not what Barry envisaged Motown putting out.
Yeah, you're right that Barry Gordy, quote him as saying that was What's Going On is the worst record he ever heard.
No. It's amazing in retrospect, but when you see the kind of material they were doing up to then, I don't think anybody would say that Barry Gordy had a bad ear, but you can see that it was very different. I mean, Barry Gordy wasn't adverse to putting out things that had political content because he had some other labels, and I think on one of these labels they put out Martin Luther King, or at least a speech by Martin Luther King, so he wasn't adverse to putting things like that out. He wasn't a man without a social conscience, but I think the Motown label itself he really saw as something for pop music, pure and simple. But things are changing. I mean, they changed in, probably changed in white pop and rock music before the soul music. So, there was a lot of socially aware music coming out in rock from about 1968 onwards. But this was quite a landmark record for black American music.
Yeah. How did Marvin's music move beyond that sweet, feel good music of his early career and of Motown in the early days, and toward the music that we hear on What's Going On?
Well, there really wasn't there really wasn't much of a transition period. I think there was transitions in his own personal life. His marriage was breaking down. His brother had come back from Vietnam, and they'd spent time talking about, you know, what life was like for GIs in Vietnam, particularly for black GIs in Vietnam. You know, he was reading the newspapers, what was going on in the inner cities, and I think he did that song, Abraham, Martin and John. That was, even though it was a song that had been previously recorded by other people, I mean, that seemed to be the kind of the first move into that direction of something about something other than every song that was recorded before that was just a boy-girl love song.
Yeah.
But what's going on was just like something completely different. He recorded a track for a group called The Originals, and that was Marvin moving into production. And that really was a new lease of life for him, because like all the Motown artists, he'd really been produced by other people. I mean, you were assigned producers, you were assigned independence. You know, I was just reading an interview today that John Lennon did in 1970, and I think there's quite some comparisons between John Lennon's kind of career as a Beatle and somebody that girls screamed at, and it was a pop item. And then at the end of the 60s, he really wanted to change. He really wanted to get serious, and he did much more introverted material on his solo albums. And you know, Marvin followed a very similar path.
Yeah, it was interesting to read in your book that as late as junior high, Marvin Gaye was unaware of black music outside gospel and Nat King Cole. Were you surprised by that?
In some ways, but in other ways not, because, I'm a white Englishman, so you have to bear that in mind. But I think there was a feeling, I gather certainly from talking to people from similar backgrounds to Marvin, that whereas a lot of white kids growing up in the 60s, particularly white kids in England, funnily enough, they liked to listen to the blues music that was created in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and they loved all that sort of thing. But then these white kids came from very sort of, well, if not affluent, at least fairly well-off middle-class backgrounds, and they wanted to kind of tear their jeans and listen to music that was sung in the Mississippi Delta. But I think the black American experience was quite different, because I think people that were raised in housing projects like Marvin was, I think the thing that they tried to do was to desensitize and forget the image of people in dungarees sitting on porches singing about hard times. So maybe not surprising that he didn't grow up with blues music. And I guess growing up in a particularly religious house and his father not liking and close to the devil's music, I guess he wasn't allowed to tune into those radio stations where he might have heard that sort of music.
He did a stint in the Air Force. What led him to enlist, and how did he do? How did he do in the Air Force?
Well, I think he enlisted basically because his relationship with his father was so bad that he wanted to get away from home. And when you were 17 or 18 years old and living in a housing project in Washington, D.C., it wasn't easy to get away from home, you know, to think that you could set up on your own. And so one of the obvious ways of getting away from home was to sign up in the armed services. And Marvin had done some, he belonged to an air cadet organization when he was in his early teens, mostly so he could wear a uniform. But so that gave him some sort of introduction to the Air Force. And I think that's the reason he picked that particular service rather than the Army or the Navy. And so he went and signed up. And it was completely not the sort of job that Marvin should have taken, because it involved discipline. I mean, he was a very sort of peace-loving, easy-going guy, and it just was not the sort of occupation he should have followed. But off he went, and he didn't last very many months. He just couldn't knuckle down to the discipline that was required. And it was interesting to doing the research because I was actually able to get his military records, and they confirmed what Marvin had hinted at in various interviews, that he was getting reprimanded all the time for not knuckling down, and then he was given what they call an honorable discharge after a few months and sent back home.
Well, they realized he was never going to make it in the Air Force, and they
absolutely
said,
yeah,
he might as well go home.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what was his big break? How did he get to Detroit and Motown?
Well, his big break was really he played with a group called the Marquees, which were a doo-wop group, and they really grew out of his singing at school underneath the stairs, where there was a good sort of echo. This group, the Marquees, just played around the Washington area. But he quite liked the Harvey and the Moonglows, who had a big hit called Sincerely in the 1950s. And Harvey and the Moonglows, that's Harvey Fuqua and the Moonglows, they came and played at the Howard Theatre in Washington, and that was one of the places where Marvin would sometimes go to see the latest groups perform. And he and his friends, the Marquees, went along, and they went backstage, and they met up with Harvey Fuqua, and I think they went back to the room where Harvey was staying, and they showed him how they could sing. And Harvey was on the point of getting rid of his current Moonglows, and so he got rid of his current Moonglows, and his new Moonglows became the old Marquees, which included Marvin. So Harvey somehow persuaded Marvin's father to sign a release and let him leave home, and off they went, and they were on the road for a couple of years, touring around the seven states and sometimes getting a little further north, and they finally ended up in Detroit. And Harvey knew people in the music business, including Berry Gordy. And when they got to Detroit, they played in a club called the 20 Grand, and that's where Berry first saw them perform. And Harvey had kind of trained Marvin to be basically his replacement. He saw him as the one. He wasn't particularly interested in the other Marquees. And that's where they met Berry. And when the Moonglows finished, Harvey and Marvin stayed on in Detroit.
Mm. Harvey was really good for and good to Marvin, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was a kind of, well, he was a mentor, and he was really a father figure, I think. I mean, he wasn't as old as Marvin's father, but he was a lot older than Marvin. And he really, I think he tutored him in the ways of life, and he tutored him in music. And Harvey played a role from then and on through the Motown years, and Harvey married one of Berry Gordy's sisters, and Marvin married another one of Berry Gordy's sisters, and Harvey was involved in Midnight Love, which was Marvin's final studio album.
Mm.
So there was a kind of, he was there at the beginning and he was there at the end.
Yeah. We've hinted earlier in our conversation, Steve, that the relationship with Berry Gordy between Marvin Gaye and Berry Gordy was not always an easy one. How did these two men view one another, and what was the relationship?
I think it was affectionate, but I think Berry was this great businessman, and obviously sort of thought like a businessman and lived like one. And Marvin was a creative person, but also quite a lazy person. And I think that I think he must have frustrated Berry many times. I think the fact that Marvin was married to his sister kind of kept him under control for a number of years. So that's from like the early 60s to just around sort of what's going on time.
Mm-hmm.
But when that marriage broke up, I think he became harder to handle. And so through the 70s, I don't think it was very easy. I think Marvin must have been a very difficult person to deal with if you were in Berry Gordy's position. You wanted product on time and you were wanting your artist to do certain things, because Marvin was someone like he didn't want to go on the road. after Tammy Terrell died, for example. He didn't want to go on the road for several years. So whatever records Marvin put out, they weren't getting promoted on the road. And then sometimes he would go on the road and he would decide not to go to the concerts for stupid reasons. You know, sometimes he'd be watching a basketball game on television and it didn't finish on time, so he'd miss the flight. And he just was a very undisciplined person, whereas Barry was obviously a very disciplined person.
Yeah, like the
But
Earth.
I don't doubt the affection between them.
Like the airport all over again.
I think he might have said that in an interview that it was, you know, he went from the regime of home and church into the regime of the Air Force, and then not very long afterwards he was into the regime of Motown, you know, which was you know, Barry had worked at one of the car factories, the automobile factories in Detroit, and ran Motown along very similar lines. You know, he wanted product to go out and on a very regular basis, and he operated the whole place like a factory. And Marvin was a part of that as well.
He married Anna in 1961, and as you said, the marriage lasted about 9-10 years. And then he married another woman, so he was married twice. Did he find happiness in either marriage?
I think there must have been... Obviously, there were times when he was happy. He seemed to have been happy with Anna, although she was a lot older than him. She was 17 years older than him. Again, he might have been looking for something which was almost like a mother-son relationship. And he went from a mother-son relationship to a sort of like a son-daughter relationship with Jan, who was 17 years younger than him.
I think
the relationship with Jan was very sort of intensely physical, almost from the word go, because she came along when he was doing the What's Going On album, and she was a friend of, well, Ed Townsend was the producer, and Ed had a friend, a woman whose daughter was Jan, and she came along to the studio, and they hit it off straight away, and if you listen to the album, you almost... There's a very strong, sort of sexy feeling on that album, and I think that's what happened to that relationship. It started off very, very intense. And I'm sure there were loving moments along the way, but it all ended up pretty badly.
Yeah. Well, Jan Day today is just in her mid-40s.
Yeah, that's amazing.
She was very young.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I met her in Los Angeles, and it is, you know, it is surprising when you think Marvin would have been over 60 now. And you've got this woman who's, you know, she's not old, and she was married to this guy who's been dead for 16 years now.
Mm. How many children?
And has his children, too.
Yeah, how many children did Marvin have?
Well, he had two with her.
And with Anna?
Pardon?
And with Anna, were there children?
Well, yes, there was one child, which is Marvin the third, and as I did the research for the book, I found out something that had never been published before, which was that what I'd read and what was said in an interview was that Marvin the third was adopted, and that sounded reasonable, but when I asked them sort of questions of people, like, well, where was he adopted from, nobody seemed to have a satisfactory answer. And then somebody told me that he was actually the son of one of Berry Gordy's nieces. Well, in fact, one of Anna's nieces, one of Marvin's wife's nieces. So I thought, oh, that makes sense. Maybe this girl got pregnant and they just sort of took the daughter, took the son in. And then somebody else told me that was true, but Marvin was Marvin. So it turned out that Marvin had this child with one of his wife's nieces, but that it had been an arranged situation. Anna couldn't conceive, and they wanted a child, and so they hooked Marvin up with this girl who was only 15 years old at the time, and they produced this child, Marvin the Third.
What effect did Marvin's death have on his children?
They were, you see, they were quite young at the time, and he'd been away a lot of the time. I know it was distressing, and I know it, I think it didn't, you know, as the years have gone on, it hasn't stopped being distressing for them because, you know, they hear his music wherever they go, and they see his name, and I suppose as they get older, you suddenly realize who the man was, and you learn more about him, and I remember interviewing Julian Lennon and him talking about his father, who he hadn't known for many years, but he said, you know, he would go into stores and hear his father's music, and it just made him aware of what a great loss it was that he hadn't known his father very well. So I think it had a deep effect on the children.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think, a big effect on Marvin III, because he's had quite a difficult life. You know, he's been in trouble with the police, and he's tried to get into show business and tried to do some things, and it's never worked out.
Mm-hmm. And the other children, how are they doing?
Well, they are the only children. That's Marvin Jr., and then there's Frankie and Nona are Jan's
children. Right. And they're doing well?
I think they're doing well, yeah. I know that Nona's got at least one child, maybe even two children.
Mm.
I don't think they've ever... I mean, Nona did a bit of modelling, and then she did a bit of... She's done some singing, but maybe she's just sort of rearing her own children now.
Mm.
But the last time I spoke to Jen, they're both still living at home.
Mm. Steve Turner is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about his biography of Marvin Gaye, Troubleman, the life and death of Marvin Gaye. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your comments and questions are welcome this afternoon. Here are telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. This was really a fun part of the book to read, how the two of them got hooked up together at Motown. What a serendipitously wonderful thing to have happened.
Yeah, they were very close, but they weren't, according to everybody I spoke to, and nobody's ever sort of refuted it since, I don't think they were ever together. But I think Motown kind of projected the image that, they projected a very close image because, I mean, most of the album covers had them very close to each other in photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was obviously, something special between them, and they looked like a kind of an ideal couple. And Marvin had a very deep affection for Tammy Terrell, and so it was very distressing for him when she'd been suffering from quite bad headaches, and she'd had some relationships with some quite well-known musicians, and I think she'd been quite badly abused, and one of them had knocked her down the stairs, or maybe even hit her around the head with a hammer, so something as bad as that. And so she had suffered badly from headaches, but they were playing at this college in Virginia, and she just collapsed in his arms on stage. And I spoke to the doctor who examined her afterwards, and he couldn't really detect anything. He just thought maybe it was maybe she'd taken some drugs or something like that. But it turned out to be more serious than that, and she died about a year and a half after that.
Yeah, 1970.
And it seems it could possibly be a result of some of this bad treatment from earlier boyfriends, and that had a very profound effect on Marvin. I think he thought, you know, how could somebody as beautiful as this be badly mistreated as that? And it was really what took him off the road for 2 or 3 years, and really led to the creation of what's going on.
Yeah. The two of them, though, together at Motown, Motown put them together, and right away they clicked.
Yeah.
And
they were always trying to pair Marvin off with different people, you know, with Mary Wells, and later on with Diana Ross, and something would happen, but it was obviously with Tammy Terrell that it really did happen.
Yeah. And their first hit was Ain't No Mountain High Enough?
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
And they knew right away at Motown they had a hit when these two got in the studio and did this.
Oh, they must have been, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I have it here. Should we listen to part of it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. You know, I don't know if it's because that I grew up with this music or not, but boy, that still sounds really good to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they had a wonderful string of hits together. But, Tammy became ill. And,
That's right.
Yeah, died in 1970. Back to What's Going On. One of the tunes on What's Going On alludes to drugs. Flying High in the Friendly Skies.
Yeah.
Talk us about this tune, and at that point, 1970-1971, did Marvin Gaye have a problem with drugs?
I don't think he had a problem with drugs. He smoked marijuana, kind of. Well, the earliest I could date that was when he was with the Marquis and, when he was with the Moonglows and came to Chicago to rehearse, but he started to take cocaine. I think he used to rub it in his gums. The guy that lived was like a house boy. That would be in the mid to late 60s. He was doing that, but I don't think it had become a kind of a gripping habit that it was to become for him in the 1970s. And there was a United Airlines advert on TV apparently at the time that said "Fly the Friendly Skies," so he used that as the title for the song. And he was picking a lot of stuff out of the air at that time. I mean, out of what was going on, things he saw in newspapers, headlines, stories. And he had a couple of unusual collaborators on that album. There was a guy called James Nix, who was an older man. I think he was in his late 50s even then, who was working at Motown. He was like a switchboard operator or something, but he also happened to write poetry and used to sort of write in a little hardback book. And Marvin hooked up with him and said, you know, come write a song, come write some songs. So James Nix got involved. And then there was this other guy called L.G. Stover, who was Marvin's houseboy, and he got him involved as well, and he kind of contributed some lyrics and also some ideas. You know, he would say, if you had that track by such and such an artist, let's do, why don't you do something like that, and they'd listen to whatever And as I say, like Inner City Blues, I think was another track that they did. They just pulled the phrase that was in the local paper, and he just liked the sound of it and pulled it out. Rather, very similar way to the Beatles were working in the 60s, mm-hmm. where they would see newspaper headlines or see a photograph or hear a story about someone and go, yeah, great, you know, we'll incorporate that into a song.
Yeah, advertising as well.
Yeah, absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah. And there was a friend of his, he liked golfing, and there was a friend of his that was working a lot with abused kids, and I think that fed into the album as well.
So this tremendous album here, What's Going On?
Yeah.
And then he falls down again. I mean, he falls badly, but comes back in 1980. Things turn around for him.
Yeah, well, his next big album was Let's Get It On, which was kind of the What's Going On of sexuality, I suppose. And I found it kind of unusual that he never really returned to the topics that he'd covered on What's Going On. He never seemed to revisit that territory, even though he'd made such a good job of it. Maybe he thought he'd done such a good job that he didn't need to revisit it. That might be the answer.
Mm.
But he did quite a good album that was called Hear My Dear, which was basically all about his divorce with Anna. They settled financially in the end by saying that he would record this album and all the money from this album would go to Anna. And he was a bit cheeky because what he did was he wrote an album that was all about their relationship and all about their divorce. It wasn't a throwaway album. It was actually might have been intended as a throwaway album, but it actually had some really good material on it. Then he came to England. He was running away from everybody. He was running away from the IRS. He was running away from Anna. He was running away from Jan. He was running away from drugs. And he ended up in London on a tour and didn't return to America as he was supposed to. And then he got taken to Belgium, where he hoped to clean up and start his life all over again. And he did, in a way, because that's where he began to record Midnight Love, with the Sexual Healing being the best-known song on the album. And that was the springboard for a huge tour of America.
Mm.
And that's when things began to go badly wrong again.
Yeah. Sexual Healing is a really interesting tune, this album Midnight Love and Sexual Healing sort of reflect how he came, I mean, his sexuality and all the troubles that he had in that area of his life.
Yeah.
But also here again is this, you know, preacher kind of coming through.
There was an album recorded, well, there was some material recorded sort of during that time and afterwards that was put out after he died. And it would go from really overt, sexual, quite nasty, vicious stuff, actually. Maybe he only intended to use it to sort of mess around in the studio, never intended to release, but there was that kind of side of him. There was that side to his nature. But then he would sing the Lord's Prayer. And even when he was behaving badly, he used to try and justify it with some kind of theological gloss to it, you know. If the spirit moves, then let's groove, or whatever, however he put it. He kind of tried to mix the theological with the sexual in that way. But I sometimes wondered, I've never quite decided in my mind what Sexual Healing's about, whether he's saying that he needed healing from all his sexual problems, or whether he's saying he needs sex in order to heal him. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But that might have been the confusion that he was facing himself.
Yeah. Fascinating figure of a man. Fascinating biography. Steve, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank
afternoon.
You for interviewing me.
Steve Turner has been our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Trouble Man, The Life and Death of Marvin Gaye. Let's go out here with an excerpt from Sexual Healing. Oh, Sexual Healing from Marvin Gaye's album Midnight Love. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Settlement prices now in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Carrie Moore.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon. March wheat had a high for the day at 284, the low 276 and one quarter. It settled 283 and one quarter, up 7. May, the high 295, the low 287 and one half. It settled 294 and one half, up 6 and three quarters. July, the high 305, the low 297 and one half. It settled 304 and one half, up 6 and three quarters. September, the high 314 and one half, the low 308 and one quarter. It settled 314, up 6 and three quarters as well. December wheat, the high 328, the low 322. It settled at 328, up 7 for the day. January corn, the high 223 and one half, the low 220. It settled at 223 and one half, up 2 3/4. March, the high 230 and 3/4, the low 226 and one half. It settled 230, up 2 3/4. May, the high 238